to ask questions of any of our panelists when we wrap up.
Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers of this panel for inviting me, Annie Manuel Byrne, and also Alex, who's
Stern,
and also Alex invited me to the panel. And, it's really a pleasure to talk to non-specialists about my work. I'm a historian. And my talk is essentially on the Young Lords in New York and their impact on the conversation around healthcare in that city. But I also want to answer the question, why did health become such an important issue during the civil rights movement, something that we are not necessarily familiar with and that we don't think about when we think about the civil rights movement. So I'm going to discuss in the center of this talk the structural and economic forces that really gave birth to a civil rights movement within the health industry. So who were the Young Lords? The Young Lords were a radical Puerto Rican organization that emerged in Chicago, New York, and other northern cities in the late 1960s. That organization was led by Puerto Rican radicals who were raised in the U.S. mainland. In many ways, these young people were products of the first mass migration of Puerto Ricans to these cities like New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia, immediately after World War II. So you probably know that the demographic character of the cities changed after World War II. They became populated in their majority by African Americans, Puerto Ricans, and other Latinos. And African Americans were part of this, were part of this migration. The organization modeled itself, the Young Lords modeled itself after the Black Panther Party. They modeled themselves after the Panthers consciously in their organization and politically. In many ways, they considered themselves the Black Panther Party's Puerto Rican counterpart. What's interesting about the Young Lords is that despite its self-professed Puerto Rican nationalist orientation, the organization was quite diverse. 30% of its members were African Americans and other Latino. And this here is not a Black Panther, as you might imagine, but rather a Young Lord outside of their office in East Harlem. So these were young people who had been radicalized by the Black Power movement and by the Vietnam War, but also by the social and economic crisis that gripped northern cities in the post-World War II period. Despite their revolutionary rhetoric, they became known ultimately for their social service activism around issues of public health in East Harlem and the Bronx. And here are some more photographs of the organization. We get a sense of their politics. They called for a socialist society, and they also called for the independence of Puerto Rico. And they spread their ideas through the publication of Palante, which is their newspaper, and Palante means forward in struggle in Spanish. So despite their revolutionary rhetoric and their ideals about building a socialist society and freedom for Puerto Rico and its independence from American colonialism, they became known for the work they did in East Harlem and the Bronx around health. In the areas of childhood hunger, much like the Black Panthers and their free breakfast programs, in the area of irregular sanitation services in East Harlem, they organized garbage protests, essentially through garbage in the middle of the street that they collected in the neighborhood, and this forced the city to essentially conduct regular garbage pickups in poor neighborhoods. They did a lot of work around childhood lead poisoning, and I'll be talking about that. And they focused on the high incidences of tuberculosis among poor city residents, again in East Harlem and the Bronx. And they focus on the inadequate healthcare delivery at Metropolitan and Lincoln hospitals. Metropolitan in East Harlem, Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, and actually Dr. Mullen was at Lincoln Hospital during this period. So essentially part of what they did was that they dramatized through their politics the deterioration of the urban landscape, which is, I think, exemplified in this photograph. So the question is, why health? Why did the Young Lords and other activists and civil rights and black power people, why did they focus on health? Well, in the case of Puerto Ricans, as the children of the first large wave of non-English-speaking Puerto Rican migrants to the city, the Young Lords and their peers grew up bilingual. In many ways, they facilitated the settlement of their parents, right, to cities like New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia because they grew up bilingual. As such, as bilingual children, they were indispensable language and cultural interpreters who helped their parents and neighbors navigate the inhospitable bureaucratic institutions of New York. The New York hospitals were among the most frequented of such inhospitable institutions, second only to the public schools. The Young Lords describe during the period and in interviews I've conducted with them subsequently, enduring alienating visits to the hospital as children. Whereas intermediaries for their parents, they were able to perceive at a very young age, quote, these are their words, how these institutions viewed us versus how we viewed ourselves. As children, these young people had witnessed the stigma and indignity of discrimination, of long waiting hours at the emergency room, and of improper care of their parents, all in the context of illness, when people feel most human and most vulnerable. These experiences rankle them to the core. The demographic shifts and the economic changes of the post-war period created a health crisis of epic proportion for the city, for New York, and its poor and working class people, increasingly new migrants who were people of color for the first time in the history of the city. So New York during this period is undergoing a structural economic shift. The economy is essentially in a process of deindustrialization. It undergoes a massive change from a blue-collar economy to a service economy. Essentially, industries are beginning to move to the suburbs and to the south in stages. This means that the new migrants to the city, African Americans from the south, Puerto Ricans from Puerto Rico, would not have access to the same entry-level, low-skilled employment which had been available to previous waves of immigrants and migrants to New York City. This is a new development. In the 1960s, the Bureau of Labor Statistics began to publish reports about young black and Puerto Rican men in their prime working years who were either unemployed, underemployed, or permanently out of the labor force for lack of success in finding employment. Again, deindustrialization in New York was creating a permanent class of unemployed people. This is the first time that this had happened in the entire history of urban life. Not in New York, but the history of urban life amongst human beings, this permanent unemployment. These structural changes in the urban economy produced a poorer population that was bound to be sicker. Independently of the experiences of racism, which itself, or the experience of racism, which itself is a complex health risk, these new migrants of color were undergoing a series of displacements which would have profound consequences for their physical and mental health. And what displacements am I talking about? Operation Bootstrap was the industrialization project of Puerto Rico launched by the United States that essentially displaced peasants from Puerto Rico, and that's why they migrated to New York. African Americans are coming out of the South and into the North. That's a displacement. Then you have deindustrialization, the fact that people can't find jobs. That's another displacement. And then you have urban renewal, the fact that people are being taken forcibly out of their apartments to make room for institutions like Lincoln Center, for example, where Puerto Ricans lived in large numbers in New York. A social psychiatrist, Dr. Mindy Thompson Fullilove, calls social displacement, quote, root shock. And she has a book of that title. Root shock, she explains, quote, undermines trust, increases anxiety, destabilizes relationships, destroys social, emotional, and financial resources, and increases the risk of every kind of stress-related disease from depression to heart attack. In the 1960s, poor African Americans and Puerto Ricans began to make more trips to the New York hospitals than whites. This is new, because prior to that period, whites went to the hospitals with greater frequency than African Americans and Puerto Ricans. This was the moment when, for the first time, urban people began to use the emergency room for all manner of non-emergency conditions. The exponential increase of these visits was fueled by the higher incidence of sickness as a consequence of, quote, root shock, but also the absence of private practice doctors in poor neighborhoods. In the post-war period, there was a 30% decline of such options in poor neighborhoods, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why. There was also a greater number of visits as a consequence of the passage of Medicaid legislation in 1965, which allowed a greater number of poor people to seek medical care. So amidst this public health crisis, city hospitals are experiencing essentially a financial crisis. Why? The city is undergoing a tax-based depletion because white workers and the white middle class are moving out of the city and to the suburbs at precisely this moment that Puerto Ricans and African Americans are moving in. In addition, private practice physicians, which previously provided pro bono service to municipal hospitals and to the poor, these private physicians are also leaving poor neighborhoods. Again, there's a decline of private physicians of 30%. In these neighborhoods. They eventually relocate to the outskirts of the city. As the tax base of the city evaporates, municipal hospitals fall into greater disrepair with no money and no experienced doctors to staff their key departments. In many ways, the acceleration of the affiliation system in the 1960s is an attempt to address the crisis in the municipal hospitals. That is, the affiliation of medical schools with municipal hospitals, which accelerated in the 1960s. What this all means is that the young lords and their generation may have experienced more stress and discrimination than previous generations, because they operated as intermediaries for their parents at a moment of greater contact between people of color and the predominantly white staff of the New York hospitals. And they did this before social movements had established a more civilized contact or more civilized rules of contact between hospitals and poor populations, and poor populations of color in particular. The confluence of deepening structural health problems with the civil rights and black power movements explain why issues of public health were so central to the debates and activism of the 1960s. And what's important to note is that the Young Lords were part of a larger movement that stressed issues of health in the 60s. They weren't the only ones. You have the Medical Committee for Human Rights. In the mid-60s, Freedom House in Pittsburgh establishes the precursor to our contemporary EMT certification. That is an incredible history of how black people in the Hill District in Pittsburgh essentially decided that they were not going to allow the cops to take them to the hospital, that they would take themselves to the hospital through this organization called Freedom House. And in collaboration with OEO in 1965, EMT emerges, and that becomes their activism and their works becomes the model for EMT in the country. Then you have the Black Panther parties. If we have breakfast programs today in schools, it's because the Black Panther Party, through their breakfast programs, essentially established a model that the nation could not say no to. Even though they're known for brandishing guns, they began their work with an ambulance service, a breakfast program, community clinics, and sickle cell anemia education in the Black community. Then you have the Student Health Organization, of which Dr. Mullen was a part, which was an organization of medical students who took up the issue of healthcare and discrimination in healthcare and the transformation of a medical school and how medicine was being taught. So what did these young people do? They launched, amongst other things, the Lead Offensive in September 1969. They found out that the city had 44,000 lead poisoning screening kits that they were not using. Essentially, the young lords decided that they would sit in at the health commissioner's office in protest of the epidemic of childhood lead poisoning. They demanded the release of these screening tests for their use in the community, and they won. They sought training on lead poisoning, tuberculosis, and anemia screening from progressive doctors, nurses, and technicians at Metropolitan Hospital. And alongside them, alongside of these doctors and technicians, they initiated a door-to-door screening project in East Harlem. They discovered that a third of the children they tested were dangerously lead positive, and they held a series of press conferences to publish their findings. And just to give you a sense, this is their door-to-door work. Prior to that, this is the letter that they circulated in the community, telling people that they were going to go to their homes and that they should let them in, that they were working with doctors. Here they are in people's homes. And the media caught on to this. Essentially, Jack Newfield, who was a very well-known and respected journalist of the Village Voice, but also writer, he takes up their story and writes a series of stories around their work, but around lead poisoning. And here you see that he writes that the young lords do city's work in the barrio. So they're having these press conferences, and they're essentially discovering that a third of all the children that they are testing are lead positive. Their radical tactics were intended to capture the attention of the media, and they succeeded. They succeeded in embarrassing the city administration. And in the aftermath, immediately in the aftermath of their work, a new health commissioner is appointed. The city launches the largest door-to-door lead poisoning campaign in the city's history. And very important, the Bureau of Lead Poisoning Control is formed. So essentially what the young lords did was that they essentially influenced the terms of political debate through their radical tactics, much like the Occupy Wall Street protesters are doing today. They put the issue of public health in New York front and center, and all of a sudden the government and the media were forced to take it up. They also occupied the First Spanish Methodist Church. Here they are in the church, and at the church they establish a program for breakfast for children. They turn the basement of the church into a social sanctuary for the poor. Here they are serving breakfast, and they also establish a community health clinic. Here are more wonderful pictures. They become endeared young people in the community, because in many ways they're serving the people. At Lincoln Hospital, they establish a complaint table for a number of months, and then they do the unthinkable. They dramatize Lincoln's deplorable conditions through an occupation of a section of the hospital. The whirlwind of controversy in the aftermath of this occupation was recorded in over 100 mainstream and alternative newspapers in the New York Times. Here you are, Young Lords Give Food and Care at Cease Church. This is an aide sent by the mayor, gets to the church, and he decides, oh my God, I'm not going to protest against these kids. They have their right. What they're arguing, that health care should be a right and not a privilege, is something that I relate to. They also take over this X-ray unit, a mobile X-ray unit. They liberate it from the city because it's not being used 24 hours a day. So the newspapers catch on and they write these articles in the New York Times, right on with the Young Lords. Then they seize the church. Here's one of the articles, Young Lords Seize Lincoln Hospital. Lincoln Hospital was known as the butcher shop of the Bronx, and this is one of the comics in their newspaper that, again, dramatizes the crisis. Here they have the demands that essentially are about better conditions in the hospital, but also better wages for workers. They're asking for a minimum wage for all workers of $140 a week. They ask for a daycare center, which they actually win. Lincoln Hospital must serve the people. This is one of the articles in their newspaper. And here we have socialism at Lincoln in the aftermath. The idea that healthcare, again, should be something that is serviced, not for profit, but because of human need. This takeover spreads to Harlem Hospital shortly after the Young Lords do their job at Lincoln, and so the city is forced to address the issue of poor municipal care. Also, the Young Lords opened the way for a detox program at Lincoln. It's the first detox program in the Western world that uses acupuncture rather than methadone in treatment of addicts, and it is still functioning today. So I'm going to end by saying that they were asking for community worker control of hospitals and clinics. They were protesting the absence of competent translators on site in hospitals, the failure of doctors to fully explain to patients their medical condition, the failure of hospitals and doctors to provide considerate and respectful care to these populations. They protested medical discrimination, the unsanitary conditions of hospitals, the fatal consequences of medical negligence, essentially everything that we understand today as a patient bill of rights. These movements were concerned with issues of social and economic import, that is the Black Power, Brown Power, and Civil Rights Movement. In fighting for their rights as human beings in hospitals, organizations like the Young Lords brought in our definition of democracy and equality. In many ways, these young people established standards of decency in the delivery of medical care and in city services for city dwellers. And essentially, these actions expanded the nation's definition of the common good. And I'm just going to end with a quote by one of the Young Lords of the period. They said that they made health a priority, quote, because health touches on the very essence of being. Thank you.
So please join me in thanking our panelists today once again. Our panelists have touched on what healthy communities mean, who is responsible. They've shared with us some of the grassroots movements of everyday people advocating for changes, fighting for human rights. They've talked to us about the barriers and stigmas of the very institutions that are meant to protect the population's health. They've talked about structural and demographic changes of poor and marginalized communities and how that has influenced the community health center. They've talked to us about some of the holistic approaches of comprehensive care. Those are some of the topics that we've heard here from our panelists. So what I'd like to do is go ahead and open up the floor for any questions that some of you may have. I'd like to start with acknowledging Dr. Lashoff. Yes.
Well, only a question.
Okay.
I would like to choose a presentation, if I may.
All right.
It's covered the Community Health Center pretty well, but one of the things you didn't touch on.
Could you come up?
Okay.
Okay. As I say.
I'm not talking that.
you for joining us.
This is also because I was originally asked to talk, but said I wasn't coming, and then with Geiger's session, I decided I was coming, by which time it was too late to put me on the program, so I said, well, I'll just take it from the floor. So here I am. The community health center movement was essentially a very important one, but I'd like to stress two other aspects that weren't touched on by Fitz. And that was the relation to the mental health movement was going on, and mental health centers were also being established, but separate from community health centers. The other was the relationship to hospital care. You had the community health center, but it was dependent on the city hospital for follow-up. We tried to be more radical in Chicago and incorporated the mental health unit into the community health center, taking the mental health state money, but using it for staff in the community health center. And the community health center in the Mile Square area of Chicago was related to the Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital, and hospitalization was to be covered at the hospital. And our initial grant from OEO included money for hospitalization because we wanted to mainstream our patients. It was, I think, one of the few grants they gave that included hospital money, and we owe Lee Shore, who was head of the OEO Health Affairs, for the effort to do that. We promised that we were sure that Medicare and Medicaid would pick it up and that we wouldn't have to have hospital money very long. And indeed, that was the case. We used OEO money for the first couple of years for a small number of hospitalized patients. But generally, once you spend, if you come from a community like that, if you're not eligible for Medicaid before you get into the hospital, by the first day in the hospital, you're in. The costs are such that you become eligible for Medicaid, so we would get everybody on that. Those were the only two points I wanted to add. Well, I'll go on to one more point, and that's the period that you talked about when the Young Lords grew up, the Black Panthers developed in Chicago. I was running a health center on the west side of Chicago in a black community. Following Martin Luther King's death, that whole west side was burned down by residents, except for the health center. The health center was not touched when buildings all around were being burned down. But it was also time for me to get out of running a health center on Chicago's west side.